On a globe-trotting theme, we welcome our next intrepid explorer, Nancy Nickerson. I still hear that song. Turn it off. Just. As I was saying, Nancy describes herself as an undercover wild child and hippie chick who doesn't believe in age or really many other limitations. Nancy Nickerson was supposed to tell this story back in January, but the cold weather made us cancel, so she has graciously joined us tonight. But back in January, the theme was courage, so that may give you some insight about the story you're about to hear. Please join me in welcoming Nancy.
I have to get this set up for a short person.
Come to the island, he said. Eat fish, snorkel, enjoy the beaches.
But he didn't tell me about all the rest. Way back in 2008, I met, as so many of us have over the years, a very nice gentleman online. But he was in Seattle, and I was in Illinois. But we had a lot in common, so we emailed, and we Skyped, and we talked on the phone. And by a story that he could be telling here tonight about how he ended up in Utila, Honduras, running a cafe for a year, this nice IT guy from Seattle. But he was a wannabe self-taught chef, and he got an opportunity, and he jumped on it. So in January of 2009, he went to Utila, Honduras. And where is this, you may ask? Honduras has three bay islands, and Utila is the small, poor child of the triplets. And long about, oh, it must have been March of 2009, he said, hey, you want a cheap vacation? He said, I'm running the cafe. You can come stay in the house. You can eat in the cafe. But if you come like about May, June, I'll have things running enough. I can take you snorkeling, and we can go see the sights. And I thought, hot damn. So I proceeded to book some tickets to go to Honduras. And there's not an easy way to get to that little island. You fly into a mid-country city called San Pedro Sula, and then you get on a bus and you go to the coast, to La Ceiba, and then you catch a ferry, and it can't be done in one day. So I was wild with anticipation, a Caribbean vacation. So I went and I did all the things you do to prepare. I packed. I went and I got all these shots for the things that you might get in a Caribbean location. I got, on his suggestion, some pills for Montezuma's revenge, just in case. And I did something I would never in my life contemplate doing. I went to a tanning bed for 6 weeks. Because he said, they come in on the ferry and they look like fish bellies. And they go back the next week and they're all burned up and they don't look real happy. So I did it in little increments, so I was just nice and brown and ready to go. So it's the day before I'm leaving. It's May 28th, and I am so ready. I've got my bags packed, and I've got my tickets, and I've got my passport. And I get an email from a friend going, did you see they just had a 7.3 earthquake there? And I'm like, oh. So I checked, and I checked with him, and he said, well, the damage here wasn't very bad, even though it was only about 60 miles offshore. But he said, I will meet you at the airport tomorrow. He said, I'll get on the ferry first thing, and I'll take the ferry and the bus, and I'll meet you at the airport. So I went, and I got on my plane the next day, and I flew into Houston, and I flew from Houston to San Pedro Sula. And as we were landing, the stewardesses said, they're having a bit of a scare here about bird flu. So you're going to have to fill out some extra paperwork and guarantee to them that you're not smuggling chickens or anything. So I'm like, okay. So we deplane, and you come off the plane into like this concrete tunnel. And there's these little gals with all these clipboards and white cloth masks. And right next to them are men in army uniforms with assault rifles. And I thought, damn, this is some bird flu. And we're inching down the line, and I'm filling out this clipboard, and I think, I don't think I'll tell them I had eggs for breakfast. But we finally got through that, and they pawed through all the luggage, and we exited into the terminal, which was one huge concrete room, and it would look pretty grim. And there were more soldiers with assault rifles everywhere. And I thought, well, this is kind of creepy. It was shades of 9/11 here in Honduras. And I have no Spanish, so I couldn't go up and say, hey, what's going on? And I didn't know how long it was going to take him to come to the airport to pick me up. And there's no air conditioning. And it's 100 and something. And steaming because it's the tropics. So, and the Wendy's that he said I could wait in the lobby was not open, and most things were not open. So I was inside for a while until I got too steamed, and then I'd go stand outside for a while to let the hot breeze take some of the sweat off, and I go back inside, and I had one of those moments standing there where I suddenly felt like a little 55-year-old woman in a strange country, where you don't speak the language, and the thought goes, what if he doesn't show up? And it's, I was very glad when he did, in a cab. And we got in a cab, and due to the way the ferries and the buses and everything runs, we had to stay in a hotel there in San Pedro Sula that night. And we got there, and there were soldiers on every street corner. And I finally had someone I could ask, and he said, oh, the president, Zelaya, is trying to force through a constitutional convention because he wants to throw out the business about term limits for presidents. And, you know, reliving this experience now has some... has some very strange reverberations. And the soldiers are because he... The courts declared the constitutional referendum he wanted to call illegal. So he tried to force the military to take the ballots to the polling places. And they basically told him to go jump off a cliff. So now you have the president here and the military here, and the military wasn't taking any chances. So they had people everywhere with assault rifles. But we had a nice meal and for dinner. Looking out the window at the military, and the hotel, thank God, was air-conditioned, so I got a little cooled off. And the next morning, we took a cab, and we went to a rather grim little bus station. But the bus could have been a tour bus transplanted from here. It looked just like one of our tour buses. It was plush. It was nice. It had air conditioning. Oh, you won't know how much I came to appreciate it after that vacation. And we got on the bus, and we're going along. And in the city, as we were leaving, you know, I expected a certain degree of grimness because the people there are very poor. And the tenements were shabby and not in good repair. But as we got a little bit out into the country, I noticed when you didn't have a close neighbor, every little shack and hut had a cement block wall around the house with razor wire and broken glass at the top. Everyone. This is how afraid those people are in their own country. And with the people arriving here now, it just, I don't blame them a bit. It was bad 10 years ago, because that was 2009. And thinking about it now just really kind of tears me up with what, but in any case. So we're putting, and we come, there is a two-span bridge that you have to go over to get out of San Pedro Sula. And traffic was all backed up. And I'm looking, and Jeff, my friend, said, "Oh, that's because one of the spans went down in the earthquake yesterday." And they're only letting one vehicle at a time go across the other one. And we're in a bus full of lots of people. So we finally we're going out, and you're looking down, and it's quite a ways down to the river, and just saying blessings on the bridge as we, but we made it across the bridge, and after that it was mostly countryside with coffee plantations and various things being grown, and it was a nice trip. We chatted a lot, and we got to La Ceiba, which is sort of an odd combination of poor and rich, because all the coastal places and the other bay islands, Roatan and all that, go into La Ceiba to get all their stuff. Because the flights out there are little hopper flights. They're small islands. So we got on the afternoon ferry, and it's about an hour on the ferry. It's about 18 nautical miles, I guess, and the ferry just kind of chugs along. It's a pretty big boat with about 50 or so people on it, and they carry the mail and supplies, you name it. So we're on the ferry, and I learned on my trip out and my trip back, you can't ride that ferry without at least one person barfing on the ferry. And I was just glad it was big enough that you could move somewhere else to get away from the person barfing on the ferry. And so we got to the island, and it was small, 2.5 miles wide by less than 7 miles long, with home to about 3,000 people that live there. During festivals, they might have 9,000 people crammed into that thing. But most of it is small houses. There are no real hotels. There are mostly houses that have been turned into hotels, or things that we might think of as a hotel, of the little by the side of the road with, you know, 15 or 20 units. But the house, the floor of the house Jeff was renting was very nice. It had no air conditioning. You can't drink the water that comes out of the tap on the island. The municipal water supply tells you, do not drink the water that comes out of the tap on the island. It's all, you have to get the big bladders of water from the store and bring them and put them up on your counter. He had little geckos that lived in the house that supposedly ate the bugs, and they were cute. He had a tarantula that lived in the window seat, and he didn't bother anybody. We never did figure out how he was getting in and out. It's parts of the island are an iguana, I guess a preservation site. So there are these enormous black iguanas that you can't hurt. But it was wonderful. The cafe that he was running was lovely. The food was great. I got Montezuma's revenge. As careful as I was, and he says, everybody gets it at least once. He said, that's why we tell you to bring the pills. So the pills helped. And I think it was my second night there. The Montezuma's revenge was having its way. So I was up at 2 and sitting in the potty, and all of a sudden, the ground went like this. And I mean, I had been through quakes in California, where they're the little shakers, where you're... This was literally a wave, where the ground went and the toilet went. And I am like, oh, and if it falls on me and they have to excavate me, she's on the pot. The story of my life, right? But even on the island, there were soldiers everywhere with assault rifles. There was a little bank next to the cafe where I could go in and change money. And there, they let 3 people in at a time, and there were 2 soldiers outside and 2 inside watching you like hawks. So changing money was fun. But the little stores were great. I was able to buy a little snorkel package in one of the things with flippers and a mask and the bubbler. And I have to tell you, if you get a chance to go snorkeling on any Caribbean island down there, do it. It was the most fantastic experience I have ever had. And it was hot. There was what they call the bar in the bush that played every night from 11 to 4. In the morning. And because it was hot, you couldn't close your windows. So you either learned to sleep through it, or you were bebopping until 4 in the morning and you slept late. The people were nice. There was fruit that would fall from the trees on the street and avocados growing in the backyard and bananas and mangoes and all sorts of good things. And it was a nice week. We went and saw the obsidian fields at one end of the island from its old volcanic days called Iron Shores, where you have to be very careful where you step. And the snorkeling, and we went in there. It's all golf carts and pedicabs because the streets are so small. A regular pickup, they're about one pickup wide. And if a pickup comes through, everybody's like, okay, get out of the way, don't get squished. And at the end of the week, I was toasty and brown and full of experiences. And fortunately, the earthquakes never came back. And we got on the ferry to go back to the mainland. And somebody threw up on the ferry. And we took the bus. And he took me to the airport, and he dropped me off. And I was glad he had warned me when I got there. You have to put $50 aside in your wallet, U.S., because you have to pay to leave the country. There is a window where you go up, and you give them your $50, and then they stamp that you can leave. And so I'm up in the little waiting area with all the people waiting for the flight. And the flight pulls up, and we're like, we're going to go home. And it was sort of a little air-conditioned in there, not much. And the plane sits, and we sit. And the plane sits, and we sit. And it's like, the plane is here. The people aren't getting off. We want to get on. We want to go home. And all the people in the airline people all spoke Spanish. And so finally, somebody that was bilingual after about an hour went up and pried out of them, well, someone had died on the plane between where it was coming from and San Pedro Sula. And due to the laws of the country, they couldn't do anything until the coroner got there. Well, Honduras is so small, it has two coroners. And it was the weekend. So there was one coroner. And that coroner was about 400 miles away. So we sat in that little waiting room all day. And finally, when the coroner got there, the only reason why we knew is a whole row of soldiers marched in with their rifles. And I'm like, this is weird. And then we wondered whether it really was old age like they told us, because when they deplaned everyone, they marched them out with the soldiers. And then they took out the gurney with the body bag on it. And then they pretty much let us stampede onto the plane. I don't think they could have held us. Clean the plane, we're getting on. Nobody even really was very concerned about which seat she died in. It's like, we want to go home. it was like, we're going home, I don't care. And with all of this, I was supposed to have been home in Chicago by like 7 o'clock that night. I got into Houston just before midnight. And of course, this was after the days when they stopped franking you or courtesying you for things, especially with an act of God. Well, they've never seen me. At midnight, after a day like that, with dead bodies and soldiers and no air conditioning, and apparently I frightened them enough, they gave me a room and breakfast. And I made it home the next day. But I have to say, you know, people would say, well, that's earthquakes, revolutions, dead bodies, blah, why? And I'd say, you know, overall, I learned some things about myself. I learned a lot about the world we live in and how very fortunate we are with all that we have. I will never take all our blessings for granted again. But I do it again in a heartbeat.